We're back with Tanki therapy, Tanki group therapy session number five. It's the beginning of December. It's been a couple of weeks since our last confessional. And once again, Sina has organized us and then dropped out. So well done on Sina. But we have Nora and we have Mateo, but we have we have Alexander Avinya and we have Rania Kalik. So hi guys. So what we do is we kind of go around, we give everybody some time to talk about what they're seeing, what they're thinking. Being shocked, continuing to be outraged is fine. It's acceptable here. Nobody's gonna tell you that you shouldn't be surprised by this or that. We can just talk about how we feel and also like what we're seeing and what we're thinking and where we think things will go. So it's the same as always. I think what we'll do is we'll give some space to our new what do we call them? Members of our circle?
Patience, yeah.
Yeah, the new members of our circle. First, but just to say, like, so
Tankies,
since
they're called tankies.
are the members of our tanky formation, so what we want to do, so just like last time, it was about 2 weeks ago. So since then, we had the pause. We saw all kinds of things since the pause, like especially I think Nora probably, or all of us can talk about the story you did, Nora, about the Al Nasser Hospital and the premature babies that died in their incubators. That was, yeah. So we have that story, which was in the news a lot, or around for us. Obviously, it wasn't in anybody's mainstream news. I don't even know if it was in the paper. A few other things, we can react to in the media. But then, of course, then the resumption of the genocide, focusing on the South this time. So, Alex, I can turn it over to you to start. Thanks for joining. Whatever you want to
Well,
share.
thanks for the invitation. So I guess I can play the role of the random listener who was taken off the street to participate with this therapy session, right? Because I think I've listened to the last four or five episodes and texting Sina saying like this has been really good for me personally to hear you guys vent and to discuss what's going on, I guess 50 or so days now. I think. And then Nora, your work with Electronic Intifada. I was the first time I listened to one of your guys' live streams. I was at an academic conference, and I missed, like, I didn't leave my room. I was supposed to have left my hotel room to go to do this bullshit work, but I couldn't like get away from the computer. So I really appreciate the work that all of you are doing. I mean, I guess my confessional here is just I feel a lot of the same rage and outrage, indignation of the stuff, the horrific violence that we've been witnessing before and after October 7th. The immediate thing that I can think of that I've probably spent way too much time on Twitter, but like one of the things that really pissed me off last week was to see certain members of the US left kind of giving strategic and political advice to Palestinians in Gaza. And I think that led me to think, because I research and write about armed struggle in Latin America and Mexico, and right, and what happens to this idea of armed struggle when we completely decontextualize it from very particular structural and material and historical conditions to then you decontextualize it, and then that allows us to just philosophically talk about what's the appropriate way of resisting and what's the inappropriate way of resisting, right? So to see someone who's tweeting this bullshit from like Los Angeles or New York offering their advice on what Palestinians in Gaza who have, what were like at 40,000 wounded and like more than 20,000 dead is just on top of everything else is just enraging. But it's really difficult to offer a counterpoint to that without people immediately online or in person throwing certain shit at you to shut down that conversation, to shut down how we can intellectually and politically and honestly understand the idea of resistance on a broad level, and then perhaps discussing you know, nonviolent, violent, and that, which I also, it's such a false binary, right? Like when you actually are on the ground or you're researching this stuff historically, for the people who are involved in these struggles, it's very often a false choice, right? Both things are happening at the same time. I remember teaching a book in a grad seminar on the U.S. civil rights movement, and there's a book called I can't remember the exact title, but something like that.
This nonviolent stuff will get you killed.
Yeah, that nonviolent stuff will get you killed. Really good, and it's this idea, right? The U.S. civil rights movement is the hagiography from like liberals in the U.S. is that it was this like nonviolent movement. But then you have, you know, if you push against that and you actually dive into the archives or you talk to people who were in the movement, right? You learn that Martin Luther King Jr. had like a virtual arsenal, right? Like in his homes, or that the photographs captured people marching nonviolently, but what they may not capture are like these armed dudes on the outskirts of the marches providing self-defense, right? And perhaps that's one of the reasons why Malcolm X will never be defanged in the same way that Martin Luther King Jr. has been, at least in the U.S. Historical imagination. So yeah, so I think that's one thing I've been thinking a lot about. Yeah, it's a really interesting book.
It was Granny on the porch with a shotgun, and in this particular story, this granny or at least one of these grannies with the shotgun was sitting on the porch, and the nonviolent activists were actually inside sleeping. So the lady with the shotgun is actually protecting the nonviolent activists so that they can do their nonviolent stuff.
Yeah, it's. I think that's like a really good, like, anecdote to explain most instances of armed struggle or just popular resistance in general. That I like that image, right, of the nonviolent students like sleeping and the armed granny defending them. Mm-hmm. Also, like the idea of trying to introduce certain theoretical frameworks from the U.S. to like I've seen this a lot too, that just like really makes me mad, where it's like, me as an intellectual living in the United States am a Western Marxist, and here is what these folks should be doing on the ground in Palestine or Gaza. And it's like so disconnected from historical and actual realities on the ground. And then they usually dive into this like prescription of what they should be doing. It's like, come on, like how can you be doing this bombs are falling? And it's just really enraging.
I did see the tweet, or at least one of those tweets that you mentioned, and somebody ridiculed it, where they said, you know, Hamas could have phone banked for Bernie, but no, they had to take the easy way out, right? So, yeah, sometimes all you can do is like
perfect. Right? Perfect.
But yeah, like
that's what you need to defuse that.
Yeah. I mean, I think I've written about this Mexican guerrilla guy. He's a rural communist school teacher who became a guerrilla leader in the 60s and 70s. And these like more urbane Mexican leftists would criticize him for not being theoretical enough. And he would respond by saying, listen, at some point, we're getting killed here, and there's no time for theory, or that there is time to organize and to resist. And your highfalutin theory goes out the window. What we're trying to do here in the mountains of Guerrero, southern Mexico, is to defend and organize our communities, because we are getting killed by the military, right? So, I think that's one of the things that's been driving me crazy. I think in addition to just, I have kids and like the children's stuff, I just break down. Like, I can't handle that. I still, you know, I'm still following and watching, and this idea that they've killed, you know, 70% of the people who have been killed or wounded are women and children. Like, they're killing the future, right? They're killing possibilities for the future. This is like an old counterinsurgency thing, right? You don't just get rid of the actual guerrillas. You get rid of the actual idea of resistance in the future. You get rid of potential future resistance by going after kids, by going after librarians, poets, the story of the president of the Islamic University in Gaza, right? Like, this is a war against an entire society that's bent on extermination. But the opposite that we get, at least in US mainstream media, is that, well, from people like Blinken and Joe Biden, well, we ask them to be nice as we're still giving them 2,000 pound bunker busters, right? While it's very clear that this is a war of extermination. I think, Nora, you've mentioned this before on previous Thanky therapy sessions, where I have a really hard time like relating to like normal people. what, you know, like I go to my kid's soccer practice and I try to bring this up and people look at me like, what's wrong with you? And I'm like, no, what's wrong with you? Why are we talking about this? As our little kids are running around chasing a ball, right? Like on a grass field. That is like really something that I'm still trying to like deal with.
I don't think we're meant to deal with that. You know, we're not like, our brains and hearts can't even process.
Yeah. So I guess that's my intro statement.
I have that trauma where every story you tell, like everything that you see in your life is like, there's a thing that the Israelis have done in Gaza. Like when you talk about soccer, I'm like, I remember that they bomb kids playing soccer on a beach and like
on the beach. Yes.
Mm-hmm. You know, I have a little baby too. Right. And I was like, and I see him lying there and I think of those preemies in the El Nasser hospital. It's like, it's like every connection that to life has like, you has a memory associated with it from this,
and the genocidal response is to be like, they're not real. They're dolls.
Right.
Which is like adds another level, right? Like another level. And I remember seeing, so also this idea of like armed struggle, right? Like why people join an armed resistance movement to begin with, right? There's always like, you can't automatically transpose like the ideologies and the motivations, the ideas of like the political military leadership to like the rank and file people who are engaged in this type of resistance, right? So which is something that like folks who research this kind of stuff is very apparent, right? Like the reason why someone like a fighter on the ground is fighting and resisting is usually different from the leadership, right? There's very personal motivations for it in addition to like political ideology or whatever. So I remember seeing a video online of this guy, Sal Qassam fighter, who was talking about how he used to be a gym trainer.
The trainer,
And he said like this, like, I just wanted to, you know, his friend got killed.
Yeah.
But his friend was killed by the Israelis, and that's why he joined the armed resistance. Like, it's sometimes as simple as that, man. Like, to understand why these folks are engaged in armed resistance, like, we have to keep bringing out these individual stories. Maybe that is one way to kind of push back against just like the unbelievable propaganda that we're subjected to. Like, it perhaps allows people to relate to, like, normies allows them to relate to individuals, right? Like, it allows them to place themselves in that situation and think, if someone came and bombed my entire family and I was the only survivor, what would I do in response? Like ideas of anger and vengeance, those are political things as well, that are just as important as highfalutin ideologies.
Oh my God, the prisoner. We should talk about the exaltation of the prisoner liberation too at some point. Right. But let me turn it to Rania now.
Yep.
Rania, how are you? Where are you? Where are you?
Where am I?
Yeah.
Well, I'm just going to, I guess, maybe like go through some of the thoughts on my mind that aren't very maybe completely as coherent as they should be. But what I'll start with is being in Lebanon for all this has been better, I think, than being in the West in weird ways. And also, of course, like more difficult than others, because it just sounds like really isolating and suffocating politically in Western countries right now. I mean, I'm not there to see it, but I just see the kinds of stuff that people have to deal with. I hear what my sisters say about what they have to deal with. And it's just like a very, like what you're talking about, you're going to a soccer game and, or your kid's soccer game. And it's like, why isn't everybody else watching this all day like I am?
Yeah.
And like my sister even told me, she's like, yeah, there's people who I work with who don't even know this is happening. And I just, it's mind blowing. Like all I do is watch the news all day. And then when I'm not at home watching the news, I'm like, you know, out doing things like regular people things, but everybody where I go is talking about this almost the whole time, whether it's at the gym, at the coffee shop, just any given place. I'm not saying all of Lebanon's like that, but it's certainly like a place where you can say what you want about this issue and it's not like going to get you in trouble and everybody else is watching it too. So that's a pretty big difference. But then there's also the fact that like, as this has been happening in Gaza, you know, there's been this like sort of low level war in the south of Lebanon. And I think the first month it was more like, you know, unsettling for a lot of people. Everybody was kind of like anxious and on edge. Like they're watching these horrifying images out of Gaza and the Israelis are promising. They're saying over and over again, like Beirut is next, Lebanon is next, you know? And it's like a form of like psychological torture on their part. Yeah. And it is meant to terrorize you. into being afraid of this crazy psychotic settler state next door that's committing a genocide. And so, you know, obviously it doesn't even come close to compare what Palestinians are dealing with. But it's still weird to be in a place where, like, for several weeks, like every couple of days, the Western embassies would send out these alerts telling you, like, leave immediately while you still can. We will not evacuate you. Leave now. Like, while there's still commercial flights available. And that, like, scared a lot of people, including me. I got really scared. I had my own little freak out. Should I stay or should I go? But not everybody has that option, right? So, like, everybody's kind of like trying to have contingency plans, but also trying to like live their lives, but also just completely heartbroken and devastated by Gaza, but also scared, like, especially if they have families. And yeah, it's just, that's like a weird way to live for several weeks, for 2 months. I mean, it's become normal now for everyone here. It's become completely normal to just live in this state of like uncertainty about what's going to happen tomorrow. Like, you might wake up and Israel started bombing. I mean, there was like weeks where you'd hear a truck go by and it's really loud and people are like, is that the Israelis? You know, and it became a joke after a while, but then to, you know, bring it back to something that I think really matters is, on the other hand, there's a reason that Lebanon isn't destroyed right now. And that's because you have Hezbollah. Mm-hmm. And I mean, not everybody thinks like that or is aware of that, but a lot of people are, I am. And I think it's one of these really defining moments of like the importance of these resistance groups and what they mean. And I mean, if it wasn't for Hezbollah, Israel could literally do whatever it wants in Lebanon. It would still occupy southern Lebanon. It could do exactly what it's doing in Gaza here. And it isn't for a reason, one reason only. And that's because there's consequences, like really serious consequences. The entire north of Israel is like evacuated of settlers. That's huge. And there's who's scared to go back. Like, I think this moment for Israel, as horrifying, as devastating as it is for Gaza, for Palestinians, for all of us whose hearts are with the struggle for Palestine, I think this is kind of like the beginning of the end for Israel in so many ways. Because like, we're just in a different Middle East now where they can't just do everything they want, how they want. But you know, another thing I'll say, just like other random thoughts on my mind, is I've been also like kind of the last, I think, week, and I think I could say the same for maybe a lot of people here who are watching this play out, is watching the hostage releases was really interesting, because it's like, you see all these videos of, you know, these Israeli hostages being, you know, released and giving high fives to like Hamas guys. And it seemed pretty genuine. And then you have the Israelis like putting, you know, completely silencing and censoring anything these hostages have to say, but little bits come out about the fact that they were actually treated with like, you know, they were treated humanely. Like, whereas you see these Palestinian political prisoners, hostages, I don't even think those words do justice, actually, coming out with like broken, like children coming out with broken arms and having been beat up and having been deprived of food and having been threatened and having their families threatened. Like, you guys probably saw Ahad Tamimi, the video of her being released, and she looked completely broken, like just completely broken. And they were like threatening her father, who they also hold prisoner. And I just think it's a real testament to like the difference between these two sides, on top of course, like what they're doing in Gaza, it's a genocide. But also, this was like really visually, like, I think, a representation of the fact that Israel is just like, has completely dehumanized Palestinians to a point where they're just like cockroaches to a lot of Israelis, to where you can like leave babies to decompose, you know, premature, helpless, the most vulnerable people, premature babies, to like die of starvation and lack of oxygen, and then spend a week, their bodies like getting moldy and decomposing. And it's just like, what the fuck? Like, what the fuck? And then Israelis are coming out with their dogs. Like, this one girl came out and her dog was with her. Don't tell me that, like, this is what, you know, going back to like these annoying sort of like, I don't know which Western leftist or Marxist you're talking about, but I have some ideas because I didn't see that tweet. But this annoying, like, moralizing from these liberals and progressives and people being like, Hamas and Israel are two sides of the same coin. Like, each side is radical. No, fuck you. Each side is not radical. One side is like genociding the other. And one side has an absolute right to like resist it by any means necessary, according to the United Nations, by any means necessary. And that's what they're doing. And while they're doing it, they still treat the other side with respect in a way they would never be treated. Like, imagine right. living in a concentration camp, or should I say like death camp, like Gaza, for years. You're not allowed out, and you're held hostage by these people who treat you like cockroaches, or like treat you like less than animals and put you on a diet. And then you finally have them like in your like under your authority. You finally have them, you're in charge, and you still manage to not treat them like shit and beat them up. That to me is a testament to humanity right there.
Yeah.
Like, you know what I mean? Like, it's just like yeah. that, the like our side still has their humanity.
Here's another tweet I saw. It was like Israeli propaganda. And then it's like, you know, spend billions of dollars, mobilize an entire military unit, censor everything that happened, you know, release videos to selected journalists, you know, curated lists of journalists, and then Palestinian propaganda. And it's just like, bye bye. And it's just
like Motaz. It's just Motaz with like in Gaza with his camera.
Yeah, they just see what, yeah.
They're just like really fondly saying goodbye to the
oh, well, this, there's yeah, the goodbye, yeah. the good luck. He told him good yeah. luck.
Good yeah. luck.
He told him good luck. And you know, the other thing that's really disgusting is there's this article that came out today. It's in the Times. And
oh, the UK the title, Times, yeah.
Yeah, the yeah. UK Times. And the title is First Hamas Fighters Raped Her, Then They Shot Her in the Head. And this is like seriously one of the worst pieces of journalism I've ever seen. Yeah. The entire thing is basically talking to one person who claims to have been an eyewitness to like all these horrifying things. Some of which don't sound possible. He no, says no, that he like, saw someone, yeah. he saw them behead someone with a shovel.
Yeah,
there's some.
I didn't know. And then the head rolled. The head
yeah.
rolled.
Yeah,
like right. I'm there's just some like
that's shovel that video that people have seen where like some a corpse, someone's hitting a corpse with a shovel.
Well, he says, and then I'm just like, it like goes on. It's like this person, and then it talks to all these other people, tries to make the claim with zero evidence, yeah. zero evidence, and zero actual testimony. This article makes this claim that Hamas has maybe, it even speculates, it's like speculation. It's mm-hmm. like some people are worried Hamas may have taken Israeli women as sex slaves the way ISIS took Yazidis.
Right.
And I'm like, how do you just say that? With yeah. no evidence? Like yeah. that's like a crazy wild claim. It's a very serious one. And by the way, I went to Iraq and I like reported on the Yazidi yeah, genocide.
You actually know.
It's actually like incredibly offensive to make that claim without evidence to mm-hmm. actual survivors of that horrible stuff. Yeah. Like, It's the whole piece is like this, just evidence-free speculation, conjecture, and yes. like quoting people anonymously.
Yeah.
And then there's like one sentence given to Palestinian women who say they may have been subjected to assault, but that's it. Doesn't speak to a single Palestinian. And there's many who have on the record said they've dealt with this from the Israeli side and also had to deal with crazy sexual threats against them and their families. Like, why is nobody caring about this? I guess Palestinian women, you could do whatever you want to them, whatever you want. But then Palestinian babies, you can literally kill them. You can kill premature babies openly with all the evidence available on camera. And then 40 beheaded babies that has never been proven to happen. And then all these crazy claims now, you don't need any evidence for it.
No.
It's like, well, it's so disgusting. It makes my blood boil.
I know. Right. I mean, they've weaponized the whole, like, you know, hashtag Me Too movement. It's basically just mm-hmm. like, trust all women. You don't trust Israeli women. Oh, you don't. Oh, you're not, you know, you're condoning rape because an Israeli woman said that she saw someone say something to someone else who saw something, mm-hmm. but there's zero evidence of it. But it's just basically a national, like, trust me, bro, sort of policy. And it's working because liberals in this country, and it's meant just for the Western audience. It's not meant for anyone else. It's meant for yeah. Western liberal Democrat women who, you know, like, made a name for themselves with the hashtag Me Too movement and the trust all women, yeah. you know, identity politics bullshit, to give cover for whatever Israel is doing and will do. And it's just, it makes my blood boil too. I can't,
you know what? It also has a very like racist white people telling you to be afraid of the rapist black men.
Yes. No, these are the exact same. Absolutely. arguments that were made in this country to lynch Black men. Mm-hmm. You know, yeah. I mean, Emmett Till was not that long ago, you know, with the same exact accusations. And this, like, just collective, yeah, just this disgusting racism towards Black men, which is now being applied in the exact same way towards Arab. You know, they just can't help themselves around innocent, you know, white Jewish women. They just can't help themselves. They're so sexually depraved.
And then you see, like, apparently these same monsters from Hamas have handed back a whole bunch of Israeli women,
yeah,
who were, like, very, you know,
very, yeah, treated like queens. You know, one of them,
like,
said,
smiling, yeah, and giggling.
Wait, one of them,
like,
said that. One of them said, yeah, she was treated like a queen.
Treated like,
yeah,
a queen.
Yeah, the mother, the one of the first, yes, releases. The, yeah, mother. There was a child and her mother, and, yeah, her mother said she wrote a letter, an open letter to Hamas, and she told them, you know, my daughter felt, you know, I know that it was, you know, I know that you guys did a lot, like, when your own, you know, like, it was some kind of, like, you guys made sacrifices, and, yeah, my daughter felt like you were, you know, she felt like she was treated like a queen. Yeah, yeah. She was a little kid. It was like, I don't know, 5 or 6 or, yeah, something. She's back, yeah, in Israel.
Yeah.
Bryce Green, who maybe we should invite to one of these sessions, but he went over this article, this Haaretz article from a couple of days ago. The scope of Hamas's campaign of rape against, right, Israeli women is revealed, mm-hmm, testimony after testimony.
In which there are zero testimonies.
Testimonies,
and,
yes.
Yeah, and someone was zero, like, contrary to the headline, this article has no actual testimonies. And the investigator that's quoted repeatedly says, I didn't take testimony. Am I the one who has to provide evidence? What kind of travesty is it that the burden of proof has to go on me? And Bryce calls it, and I think this is really good, he says, this is epistemological warfare. It's like, yes, warfare on, like, the meaning of words, warfare on the ability to think coherent thoughts.
Yes.
The idea that there should be evidence for claims.
But, you know, I think we were saying this with Bikram last time, Justin, and this is really a war on... We called it the war on humanity, because, I mean, I was listening to what Rania was saying, and, I mean, you got this huge amount of propaganda banking on the Islamophobic racist culture of the West, which is just propaganda. And they know it's going to work because, you know, the West is basically, you know, this large pool of people who hate Muslims and brown people. So it's going to work, you know, by standard, by default. That's it. They don't need anything. They're just going to do it. And on the other hand, you have this, you know, this new level of humanity, you know, that it's coming out of the resistance, you know, it's just, which is so, like, wow, this is going to remain in history. I know it will. We might not see it right now, but it's going to remain. It's just so revolutionary what they're doing, you know, mm-hmm. The way they're taking prisoners, the way they're fighting this war. They can't really fight the war at the genocidal, you know, level that, you know, that the Israelis are doing. So they have to come up with really a different cognition of humanity. And this is what they're doing. But it's, you know, anyway, shut up.
Yeah. You want to just continue? Do you want to continue sharing, Matteo? And then we'll get to Nora after.
No, okay. Yeah, I mean, I was just, I think I should, you know, it's first probably... I just want to repeat that I'm not going to normalize what it's happening, in the sense that it is unprecedented, and there is no way that I can go back to some kind of normal status quo. So I will, by this I mean the genocidal drive, but also I will keep pushing and nagging to anybody who doesn't, you know, doesn't feel like that. So. That's one. Yeah. It's unprecedented what we're witnessing. Then I was thinking about, you know, personally, I feel I am, I've been thinking about how much I am in a state of alert, you know, with the news, when I am hooked on Twitter, which sometimes it's not helpful, I have to say, but, you know, it's just like, boom, 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 you're constantly thinking something might come. And the cognitive effort that I make just to sit and work, I mean, 4 hours of work for me, it's like 10 hours right now. Because I cannot let the emotions come in. And there are a lot of emotions, all the ones that you guys are describing. There is rage, there is anger, there is sadness, there is depression, you know, there is all this. It's, you know, it's not normal that we have to see, you know, they restarted and today is 700 people. And you see the details, these fucking details, every single time of these individuals that Alexander was talking about. It's not normal. We can't let this pass. We cannot. And it's, you know, anyway, said that, there is a little bit of clarity, which was already there. And the clarity is on things like, you know, I don't know, something just hit me and I just want to say it all over again. I know we're Syria, you know. Syria is key. I don't care. It couldn't have been destroyed. It shouldn't have been destroyed. There was a plan there. And if you are understanding what it's happening now, you need to look back and at least question your position if you ever, your political position was, you know, to destroy the national sovereignty of Syria. I have to say this because it's, these things are becoming so clear right now. And there is more, you know, there is also, I'm sure you've seen the article by Rashid Khalidi as well, where he made that really unnecessary.
He was interviewed?
Yeah, I was interviewed.
Did you guys see this, Rania, Alex?
No, I didn't.
Rashid Khalidi was interviewed, I think yesterday, the article came out, I think in the New Yorker. And I didn't read the article because, you know, I'm too sensitive right now. I'm emotional. But the pull quote was, and I think I remember it verbatim. The pull quote was like something like, if a Native American liberation movement were to launch a grenade at my apartment because I'm a settler here, that would be unacceptable. You either accept international humanitarian law or you don't.
Who's he talking? I'm confused. Was he making, what was the point of saying that?
Armed resistance, Rania.
Yeah, he was talking about
armed resistance. He thinks Hamas is wrong to defend, to like,
yes,
fire.
And this is the man who wrote 100 Years War on Palestine. Like, I don't understand the utility of that argument.
What a way to slander Native American, actual Native liberation movement.
Exactly.
They've never done that. Like, and, you know,
they've done
I don't know. I wouldn't find that.
So what are Palestinians supposed to do? Do we know? Are they just supposed to die?
I don't know. Rashid Khalid, this is why it's devastating, right? It's like, are you sure? Like,
his colleague, Edward Said, was the one who had bulletproof windows in the same universe. Like, it was like the attacks
wasn't
going to come from another side.
It wasn't against Native liberation movements either that he had those windows.
No.
Right.
Sure wasn't.
I saw someone.
Oh my God,
hold on.
Can I just read what he actually said? It's crazy. Yeah.
It's a longer interview.
What you said.
Someone pulled that quote from like a longer interview to make.
Is it worse or is it better? Like,
I want to quote him correctly. Rashid, in case you're watching.
For the record, Rashid Khalidi has been on this show. He's been on Cena's show. So.
Oh, damn. Okay. So if a Native American liberation movement came and fired an RPG at my apartment building because I'm living on stolen land, it wouldn't be justified. You either accept international law or you don't. Like, what came after that?
What? Like, did you read it, Alex?
Yeah.
No, I'm searching anything. Now. I need to know. I'm like,
yeah, it's a longer article. I mean, I think the person is it out of
context?
Yeah.
The rest of the article is okay? Is it what's going on?
I mean, I think like having listened to Rashid Khalidi on several different podcasts, I mean, he comes back to this point about attacks on civilian populations as being against international law. And he thinks about he doesn't moralize the idea of armed resistance, but he talks about more about its political utility or lack thereof. So if it doesn't work, then he critiques it from that perspective. He's not necessarily critiquing it from a moralizing perspective. And he,
but like, who's apparently holding Israel to the standard?
Right. I mean, that's moral.
But that's it, right? That's the contradiction right there.
Yeah.
Right? There's a political cartoon I've shared on Twitter before from like the Boxer Rebellion, and it shows, it's from like a French newspaper from like 1899 or 1900, where it shows like a Boxer rebel about to like strike a French troop or colonial troop, and it's called like, and it has a description underneath it as barbarism. And then when it's switched and it's like the French troop about to do the same to the Boxer Rebellion, is called civilization. That is still like painfully obvious. Like, that logic is still painfully obvious to this day, right? I mean, people have made this point, right, that what's been going on the last, you know, 50 plus days and even longer, obviously, is that this type of like 19th century colonial warfare.
Yeah.
And I don't know if I'm like totally in agreement with that for different reasons, but that logic is well at play. And again, it's a logic that works really well for like US and European audiences.
Yes.
That's the thing that strikes me about a lot of this propaganda.
Yeah, he's not taken so out of context. Tailored. Sorry.
You were skimming.
It's part of the,
But yeah, sorry. Like, go ahead, complete what you're saying. Sorry.
No. It's just like the way that these messages and this propaganda is tailored to like a Western audience, a US audience.
Yeah.
It's so obvious, right? It's they know what buttons to hit, what tropes, what themes.
Like that, the contempt for international law that Israel has shown, the amount of like spitting on it, and like Mateo on Rania's show, you guys, you said this, Mateo, you were like, international law is buried in the rubble. Like,
I don't know, Justin. When I think about Israel, I mean, it was built, you know.
Yeah.
Without international law. So, I mean, why should we expect Israel to... Right. That's the thing, you know, it's like...
So
I can't say it out loud, but...
Rashid is saying either you expect it, either you accept it or you don't. And then it's like, so what? Like, who in this universe of international relations accepts international law? Like, Rashid does, I guess. I don't know if his interviewer does, probably not, if they're, you know, if they're a mainstream American pro-imperialist person. Like, what is this international? What is this fictional object?
Yes, that doesn't, what is this?
Like, what joke. Are...
It's a joke.
It's meaningless. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Meaningless. I mean, we have Karim Khan, right? The IC, the International Criminal Court prosecutor, going to Israel to express his sympathy and condolences and basically vowing to prosecute Hamas for breaches of international law, and essentially giving Israel a complete pass for the genocide that it is.
Yeah,
and what is the point of anything? What is the point of anything?
All I think when I see these things, I think I've had this thought in my head so much this week in particular, as I've seen people spreading this map of like where they want Palestinians to go in the Sinai, and people spreading this thing like, you know, they want the Palestinians to all go to different countries, and they have this plan and they have that plan, and they're going to do this, and now they're saying ICC is going to prosecute Hamas. And I'm just like, every time I read these things, I'm like, Israel better win the war first. Like, I mean, you got to win the war first.
Yeah, they're not.
None of this stuff is going to happen. Sorry, Ren.
But we also have to keep that in mind, right? Like, is Israel really winning? I mean, Israel just massacres civilians, but we know that militarily speaking, they are facing fierce resistance.
Yeah.
And I mean, like, blowing up residential buildings doesn't really change that. It just kills civilians.
Exactly.
But it's also, you know, it's just so crazy. God, imagine if after the Warsaw Uprising, they're like, we're going to be prosecuting the resistance in the Warsaw Ghetto for committing war crimes against Nazis. Like, that's kind of all I hear.
No, that's literally what it is.
Yeah.
That Karim Khan is now visiting the German SS and saying, "Oh, we're so sorry that the residents of the ghetto rose up against you. So sorry. We're going to prosecute them to the fullest extent."
It's crazy. Yeah,
but like, that's the thing people don't understand about the International Criminal Court is you actually need an armed organization to enforce the law. And in this case, the only people that can enforce the law against Hamas are the Israelis. And they're doing their best, but I just don't see it happening. I don't see it happening. So,
I have a question for you guys, since you're all in different bellies of the beast. What do you think about like the actual, have there been any like material gains, do you feel, from like all the protests across the West? Cause there's been so many, there's all these actions. Have they translated, do you think, in any sort of like pressure politically? Will they at some point?
I want to say one thing, and then I want Nora to have her time. The one thing I want to say is in Canada, In Canada the other day, there was someone from a small Canadian media organization, but she's, I don't know, some kind of liberal thing. And she said, look, we have no influence on what happens in Israel-Palestine, but we do have influence on how we treat each other. And we cannot allow this issue to divide Canada and destroy and tear our society asunder. And so lots of ridicule of that, right? Someone responded with like, here are 100 things that Canada does for Israel, right? But I kind of thought that was a good sign. Like, if people are saying, you know, our society is coming apart at the seams over this issue, that actually is, you know, what probably the only way that you would get a society like Canada or the US to change course on this issue. So in that sense, I'm like, if people are worried about that, then I suppose there is some effect. But, you know, obviously the overwhelming feeling that I have is just complete and utter helplessness, you know, and like an inability to affect the outcome.
Yeah.
Nora, do you want to take up the question and then?
Yeah. Sure. Yeah, I go back and forth, honestly, about like the utility of the protests and whether we're seeing any like material gains or changes. And on good days, I'm like, yeah, this is like sparking much needed, you know, necessary conversations about not just, you know, Palestine and the struggle for liberation, but also U.S. imperialism and the role that Western hegemony plays in the destruction of people all over the world. And that, you know, and I'm seeing like, you know, people my daughter's age, she's in her early 20s and she's, you know, all of her friends are apparently always talking about what's happening in Palestine. You know, maybe that's just because she's my kid, but like, you know, but she says like there's no one her age that she knows who isn't completely outraged and, you know, and hates Israel, you know, so like, which is good, which is, you know, marking a sea change, not just in the US, but also like, I think specifically in young Jewish American communities where these conversations are way overdue. You know, I think that it's great that there's a growing rift in the American Jewish community around Zionism and around white supremacy and Israel, you know, as a colonial state. Like that's great. Those conversations should have happened 75 years ago, but they're happening now. So that's good. But then it's like, well, but all of these millions of people in the streets all around the world all the time, and people are, you know, doing incredible direct actions against like Elbit systems or against the, you know, the here in the Bay Area, the port of Oakland, when activists like literally scaled the ladder to this one ship that was, you know, supposed to be transporting weapons to Israel. Like those are amazing. And I don't know if anything's literally changing. I mean, yeah, just like, you know, Alex was saying, like there's, the Biden administration just sent like a whole new shipment of like 2,000 pound bunker busters, you know, like, so I don't know. I don't know. I get very, I just get very like confused. Like what's the point? I get very nihilistic.
Before you go too far down that road.
Yeah.
I will say, it doesn't always, it's not going to translate one-to-one, and it's not going to translate short-term. And also, just so we're all prepared, it's going to get worse here before it gets better.
Yes, absolutely.
This issue is going to be the reason conservatives win the next election in Canada and Republicans win the next election in the
US. That's right, yeah.
100%.
Because when liberals are pro-genocide, the liberal
base is like every day.
The liberal base can't get excited. You can't get them excited about it. Right. You can't get them excited because the other guy's more pro-genocide. It's just, they're going to stay at home. It's like, it's science. It's not like no amount of hectoring them and lecturing them and trying to make them feel bad about it is going to work. They're not going to vote. They're not going to go.
They're being offered the compelling choice of concentration camps or deportation, right? I mean, that's what they're telling Arab American voters.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Like
either you want to support a genocide, or the next guy who comes in is going to put you in concentration camps and then expel
and
that
you. That's smug. That's smug. Like right. enjoy your deportation. Yeah, right? exactly. There's all that, like disgusting. All those tweets of like, yeah,
Democrats famously not known for, you know, organizing racism? Deportation.
No. no.
Deporting 3.5 million people during the Obama administration.
Right, exactly. That's kinder, gentler deportation.
Yeah, it was okay. He felt badly like, about gave it. Them a kiss
deportations with a rainbow them. Flag, right?
Yeah, yeah.
I remember Angela Merkel telling a Palestinian, was it? She was telling either an Afghan or a Palestinian, like, I'm sorry, but you can't stay in Germany or something. It was
she said that, yeah.
Very moving, like, moment.
But you know what I was thinking about this protest is that... you know, there's a friend of mine who says that this is just a facade to show that the West has some sort of democratic environment. You know, you can go out mm-hmm. and do it about Palestine. But I don't think it's necessarily like that. You know, like that's mm-hmm. too cynical, I think.
Yeah.
But it might, it's not, if the issue is kept there, then cumulatively and with different, because we can't fight at the same pace of the genocidal drive of the West, of the Israelis. There isn't. Your resistance can't come like that. We need to really show a different path, and it needs to be a long-term path. The test for us in the West would be if we're able to keep this at, you know, now we know it's there. Now we know we have to keep going. Is this a moment for a turning point? Will it stay there? It's obvious that, you know, when you look at what it's happening on the ground and then you look at the process, you're like, oh, come on, fuck this.
Yeah.
You can't match that pace and the tempo of what they're doing. It's impossible. You know, it's literally impossible. But eventually...
We don't want to. Also, we don't want to.
Yeah, we don't want to.
Sorry, I didn't want to cut you up. I just want to add that, like, there isn't a genocidal drive, period, here. Like,
yeah, that's right.
It just doesn't exist. And it's not because, like, oh, like, you know, our side's so superior. But in a way, it is because morally we are. Like, it's like, even my friends and I have had this conversation a lot about how... You see the hate and racism and genocidal drive of Israelis. They're celebrating the death of babies and they want more of it.
Yeah.
Because that's what a settler society has to do. That's what it does, right? I've never seen anyone in my family. I mean, I have a big Lebanese family. I've never seen anyone in my family my whole life. They hate Israel for obvious reasons. Never seen anybody be like, I want their children to die.
Yeah.
Like, I want to see the babies die.
Oh, exactly.
Like, it's not the same because it's like, settler colonialism versus indigenous people.
Yeah.
And there's just, I mean, maybe there's people who do think that. I've never heard it. I've never heard it. You know what I mean?
No, yeah, exactly. I mean, exactly. Like, we had our good friend Tarek Lubani on the show on the EI live stream a couple days ago. And he and I were talking about the story that I wrote that you referenced earlier, Justin, about the five premature babies who, it's hard for me even just to talk about it, but like they were basically left alone to die, starving and suffocating and cold and alone for 17 days before they were found by a journalist at the Al Nasser Pediatric Hospital in Gaza City. And this was after the medical staff, physicians, the parents of these babies, other displaced people in the hospital were ordered to leave by the Israeli military at gunpoint. And the doctors and the parents said, please let us take these babies. Obviously, they'll die if they're not looked after. And the Israelis, it's unclear whether they said that, oh, the Red Cross will take care of them, or if the Red Cross said, yeah, we'll take care of them. Neither the Israeli military or the Red Cross, nobody took care of these babies. They died alone, and they were found 17 days later. But... like I was talking to Tarek about it, and he said, he as a physician, right? And he's Palestinian, and he's spent years of his life working at Al-Shifa Hospital in Gaza City. And he said he was like, he couldn't believe that the Israelis would have known that these babies were going to die and left them. He was like, there's no way. I can't believe that they would do that. I can't, you know, because for normal people with a brain and heart, no matter what nationality premature babies are, you would never leave them alone to die. You just wouldn't. But we're talking about Israel, which is a genocidal, psychopathic settler state. And of course, Israeli soldiers left these kids to die, because to them, they're not children. They're human beasts, right? They're like, they're preterm terrorists, right? That Israel has indoctrinated everyone in that society to believe that Palestinians are not worth saving, are not worth that these babies should just die. And for any normal person, it's almost impossible to understand that. It's like, I can't imagine, you know, like any resistance group. If Hamas, you know, God forbid, took over an Israeli hospital in the middle of Tel Aviv, I can't imagine that anybody would leave babies to die. They wouldn't.
Start to finish, they wouldn't have taken over the hospital. Hamas could have attacked a hospital by now.
Right.
Yeah.
That's nothing special militarily.
Right.
They've been fighting.
That is a soft target, as they say.
They've been fighting bulldozers. Right. They've been fighting armored personnel carriers.
Right.
They don't have to do that.
No.
That's harder than attacking a hospital.
Right.
So, like, if they had that impulse, they had ample opportunity to follow it.
Right.
Like, this is and it's like people in the media who have, you know, I was saying I needed this therapy session because there's like one character that's been living rent free in my head for the past 2 weeks, and it's Piers Morgan. And send this around, I watch it. And then I watch Finkelstein on Piers Morgan, and then I watch Gabor Mate on Piers Morgan. And the stuff that he says, like, I watched Andrew Tate. In fact, the most satisfying one that I watched was Andrew Tate, because as much as I revile Andrew Tate, like, Andrew Tate is like a bully too, right? So
yeah,
Piers Morgan is this big bully and he's screaming at you, and Andrew Tate is bigger and he's more of a bully and he's screaming back. And it's like, it's a little bit satisfying where, like, at one point Piers says, like, Piers says, you know, what do you think of the war or whatever? And Tate says, well, you know, it's not a war, it's a genocide. And then Piers Morgan says, which side is waging genocide?
Oh my God.
Yeah. And then Tate says, he says, the Israelis are waging genocide and you know it. And then Piers says, no, I don't know it.
Oh my God.
And then Tate's just like, well, maybe your bosses aren't letting you know it then, which is like a pretty good, it's a pretty good. And then at another point he says something like, Tate says, no, I want to ask you now. And it's like, he's getting aggressive. And he's like, I want to ask you now, what would you do if, you know, all these things were to happen to you? And Piers Morgan suddenly is like, well, I don't think we can judge off of like what individuals think. And then Tate is like, that's all there is. There's individuals. That's all there is, Piers. It's not cattle or something. And it was like,
wow.
That was like the only cathartic moment. Like, when I see people like Finkelstein or like anyone just being polite to someone like that, it feels very dehumanizing to me. Like, how can you be polite to someone who can't figure out which side? And Piers has just lied. Like, when the Israelis said 1,400 people were killed on October 7th, Piers was saying 1,500 civilians.
Mm-hmm.
Then they revised it to 1,200, and now they've revised it again. Did you guys see? They've revised it to 1,000.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. They've revised it to 1,000 now. The official Israeli account said over 1,000 now, and I expect it'll be revised again.
They deleted all the videos from October 7th on the border. That's something else that they did.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Surveillance video. Yeah, there's an article in The Cradle that Mateo sent around. Right. Yeah. There's an article in The Cradle about how they deleted surveillance.
Guys, footage. I have to like leave the therapy session because I only had an hour. I'm sorry.
time
to go soon. But this was very nice. I appreciate being invited and being a part of it.
Thank you.
Love you, Rania.
Yes.
Thanks, Rania.
Everybody have an amazing day.
You too.
You too.
Bye.
Bye.
But yeah, I mean, I was like, I don't know. I tweeted this morning before I had my coffee or anything, like I saw Mooin Rabbani, who sometimes is like
on, he's sometimes on and on, off.
Sometimes yeah, off. Sometimes yeah. Off. Exactly. He tweeted about this new poll. I think it was in Time magazine. Did you see this? That like only 1.8% of Israelis think that the Israeli military is bombing too much. 1.8%.
Yeah.
Right? So that means like 98% of Israelis are all in. They're all in with the genocide.
Yeah. Just varies with how much genocide they want.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Right. Exactly. A little bit more or a lot more. Like it's just, exactly.
Fluctuating.
Yeah. So like, what do we do with these people? What do we do? What do we do with this criminal state?
I saw that their new number one song on the charts is like,
oh yes.
My, I don't know if you guys saw that, but
calling
it's like,
for the deaths of Dua Lipa.
Yeah.
Mia Khalifa. And who's the third? Some other.
Yeah, there is a third one.
Figure of Hadid.
Bella Hadid.
So they've declared war on every attractive pro-Palestine.
But can I ask a question to Alex?
Of course.
Because I was wondering if, you know, Alex, you've been working on guerrilla warfare and, you know, and kind of, you know, in Mexico. And I'm just, you know, when you look at what it's happening in Gaza, like how do you see the you know, from a, not from a strategic point of view, but I mean, like, is there any lesson you're bringing from your research, what you're seeing? Is there anything that, you know, like, I don't know, I'm just curious. Yeah.
That's a good question. I mean, I think it's there's certain aspects of this, obviously, that I think are exceptional, but this is just asymmetric warfare, right? Like this is, and something that always happens, right? Like from the Romans fighting the Thracians to today, like the people, the powerful ones will complain about how the less powerful ones are fighting.
Mm-hmm.
And that's like one of the things, right, that's been really striking standard. Is that people in the media, well, why they're hiding in tunnels and they're not coming out to fight. Well, no shit. This is like, this has always happened in guerrilla warfare. Like there's a correlation of forces, right? And that the weaker side is going to use factors that are in their advantage. So that whininess that I've seen in like the Western media about, well, these fighters don't fight fair. Well, yeah, that's the whole premise of guerrilla. Guerrilla means small war. Like the people who have less power are going to fight with what they have, right? I mean, it's obvious.
That's right.
But they always whine, right? And in that whininess, it's a perhaps an inadvertent revelation of their weakness.
Hmm.
I think this is something too that you see, like the more coercive violence that you practice, like militarily or even discursively, the weaker you are, actually, right? Like I think that's like a, I don't know, maybe it's like too Gramscian, but like, I think the way that like people who are pro-Palestine in the US have been attacked, right? Losing their jobs. Like the fact that that's so out in the open now is actually a revelation of how weak the pro-Israel side is. The fact that they have to resort to those things, like shutting down Students for Justice in Palestine chapters. Or what happened at my university, Arizona State University, a couple of weeks ago, they disinvited Rashida Tlaib.
Yeah.
And my university gave a bullshit response about, well, it was like groups off campus who organized it. And that's why we shut it down like an hour before. No, what happened was state politicians put pressure on the university and the university acceded. But in that act, which is coercive, it's an inadvertent revelation that like they're weak on this. It's going to take forever. Like you were saying, Justin, this is going to take a long time, but something is changing. Something is changing. The political ideological correlation of forces are changing in the US. It's just going to take forever. I mean,
they're willing to totally disrespect a member of their own government to do it, right? Like, there is a sign of like, it's a sign of weakness, but it's also a sign of like how far they're willing to go, how much they're willing to destroy of their own credibility and their own,
cohesion. And in Arizona, it was a bipartisan group. So it doesn't matter, right? Like it's never mattered, right? And
issue, like Palestine is it's a universal condemnation from any political party.
And it's going to take a long time, right? Like the history of U.S. state formation is to render immune certain aspects from democratic pushback. And one of those is foreign policy, right? The economy and foreign policy. But so the fact that we matter, right? Especially when you are a global empire.
So
it's going to take a long time.
There's a question I want to throw to you guys. I don't know what you guys think, but like there's a mystery, a genuine mystery. I don't have too many of these per week, but I have one. One is, and it's like several of these. What you retweeted this one, Rania, where Hamas is Haaretz. Couldn't be different institutions. Haaretz published a front page, I think, story basically saying a lot of the stuff that we've been saying about October 7th is not true. Right. So they've basically said, you know, no beheaded babies, no mass rapes, da, 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 da. We don't have any evidence for any of it. And it's not true. And the truth is bad enough and so on. That's one. And then the other one is the Jerusalem Post, where they said this, you know, baby that we killed is a doll. And then they deleted it. And they said, you know, we take this seriously. What I don't understand is not why they published the lies. What I don't understand is why they corrected it. Does anyone have any idea why they corrected it? Because I kind of think that my understanding of my analysis of it is like when they do these big lies, they're like, we can lie and none of you can do shit about it. And I think that's like part of the pleasure of being the imperialists is that we can say whatever we want and you can't do anything about it. You know, dare us. I dare you to ask for evidence. I dare you to contradict this story. I dare you to say it wasn't a doll. And so why do they correct it?
Yeah, it's a really good question.
I am going to reason this in the, you know, in the binary view of you just described fascist imperialism. I'm going to lie, can't do anything. That's the other one is liberal imperialism.
Okay. So it's diversity just to keep us off our...
Yeah, I that's you know.
Yeah,
know.
To like to keep the pretense that they're a you know a news organization with standards, something like this. It's I mean that was basically the Jerusalem Post's statement, right? It was like it was not up to journalistic standards. I mean, it's
you don't say.
It's very cherry picked, obviously. Yeah. But yeah, I think it's just so that they don't piss off their more liberal readers. I don't know.
So they need that. Liberal.
Yeah, that's true. That's
I think
true.
It's a question of audience.
Yeah.
I think it's a question of audience.
That's good.
I think, I think, and even like the reason why they started calling September or October 7th at like a 9/11, right? Again, that's when in actuality, like the original 9/11 is, you know, Chile and Allende, which I was
exactly.
But yeah, I think it's maybe a way to get at this mystery is to think about the audience and maybe in this instance they stepped too far, which is like because it was like horrific, like when I saw the original video and then I saw the pushback that I was so angry, right? But I wonder how like a normie US like person who's consuming social, like I wonder if they had a similar reaction where it's like I just saw like a dead baby and then the other side is responding by saying that's a doll.
But
there's something so messed up about that maybe that's like it's too much like this, so they had to step it back. I don't know.
The other one that was too much that I was like some of these things I see and I feel like I'm glad they do this so that, and what his name is, Yoni something, you guys saw that Yoni guy? So some Yoni guy who's like some kind of musician, and he wrote if you're showing me dead babies, you should know that I could care less. I couldn't care less. That's what the phrase "I couldn't care less" was made for. And I was just
and that's Israel in a nutshell, right?
Yeah,
you're like, keep talking, like, please.
Yeah,
keep talking,
please.
Him and the Borat.
Show us
guy,
more.
Say more.
Say right,
more.
The Borat guy.
Yeah, the Borat 2 guy. That loser. Yeah, keep going, man. He just had a horrific one yesterday or today.
What did he do?
Too. It's like
what?
Oh, I got another one of these horrific.
Oh,
just
yeah.
Like genocidal maniac tweets.
Yeah.
Similar to the Yoni guys.
Okay.
Yeah. Keep talking, please.
Yeah.
Keep
John Lovitz, too. You know,
Lovitz. There's an
D-list actors.
David.
Yeah. All these people. Rap. Oh, God. No, he's.
SNL has a weird, it's like a weird seedbed for like American fascists. It's weird.
It is. Get rid it's of very Saturday interesting. I know. Like too many. Where were they radicalized? Saturday Night Live.
It's a hotbed.
I like that.
But like, how do we, let's conclude with like, how do we help others? I don't know. Like we... I don't think that this is like these are dark times, but I, you know, as we move, as this becomes clearly like a real protracted people's war, to use guerrilla warfare terminology, I mean, I don't think Israel can win this. No. You know, at the like when I analyze, like there's these feelings that I'm having, this trauma that we're all feeling as we watch this, and like. But like, I don't rationally see Israel winning this. Well, I don't even know if they know what it means anymore.
Right. So, why they're just killing.
Yeah.
Like, after this, I don't understand how it goes, the previous ideological cover for this settler colonial project, like goes, like it can't.
No, it can't. So well, my tweet that I tweeted this morning about the, you know, kind of just commenting on the less than 2% of Israelis who think that there's too much bombing. My proposal, and this is not just me, like I've heard this, you know, throughout the years, but like, you know, Europe should gather cruise ships and they should go to the Tel Aviv port and they should gather up all the colonizers and send them back to Europe. I mean, Helen Thomas talked about this, right? And she got completely skewered in the last years of her life. They should go back to Europe and live out their colonial fantasies there. Why do Palestinians and Arabs in the region have to pay the price for Europe's, you know, settler colonial project in Palestine? Why do they have to pay the price for the European and inherently European ideology of anti-Semitism? Why do Palestinians keep having to pay this price? Israelis should either stay as guests, well-behaved guests in Palestine.
I mean, they don't have to be exceptionally well-behaved, just non-genocidal.
Non-genocidal.
Yeah,
that's right, yeah. But also, I mean, can you live a normal life without... U.S. aid pumping your own economy, or you know, can you accept to go to work and you know, and all that? Can you live without all that security aid? Can you actually live in a state that is not an arm of U.S.? Can you renounce that privilege? You know, once you do that, maybe I'm sure you will, you know, because you don't want to renounce that, then you're gonna go back to Europe.
Yeah, many, you know, a lot of them are doing already right now.
It would just be such a completely different state, right? Because to your point, Matteo, like so much of the Israeli economy depends on like arms exports.
Yes.
And like now, and like digital counterinsurgent tools.
That's true. Who wants that stuff now?
The Mexican army loves Pegasus, I'll India. Tell you that.
Yeah, I mean, that's true.
The biggest customer, actually.
That's true. But look, Israel's, you know, it's like vaunted surveillance systems and all these I mean, the Iron Dome is like, it's like malfunctioning all the time. It just like bombed another Israeli's house somewhere, like in southern occupied Palestine, right? So Iron Dome is malfunctioning. Their surveillance system is completely gone. I mean, you know, Hamas led the most spectacular military action on October 7th that completely dismantled this like vaunted surveillance system that Israel has touted and has sold all over the world. So they, you know, their military, you know, privilege that they sell around the world is plummeting. They can't, who would trust Israel's, you know, Pegasus, but like the, you know, the other surveillance tech that it sells when it has failed so spectacularly and continues to do so. I mean, so that's, you know, that's a win for us.
So it's really, you know, I guess, Alex, because you're here for the first time, like it's ultimately like this type of war / genocide, the the main thing to do for the side that's resisting is to stay alive, right? Just to hold on.
Yeah.
And then you hold on until you win. You hold on until things change.
Yeah, and there's different temporalities at play as well, right? I mean, with this genocidal campaign, Israel just created like generations of future rebels and revolutionaries, yeah. right? So the immediate temporality is, yeah, the resistance needs to find a way to essentially wait them out. I mean, that's one of the things of guerrilla warfare, right? Like, you don't necessarily win a decisive military victory on the battlefield. You wait them out. You defeat them on other planes, with a possible exception like the Vietnamese, right? But even that's like a more complicated story with, and I'm talking about 1950s against the French.
Mm-hmm.
But I think waiting, and then to see like what happens in the international community. Like, I don't know if you guys watched at the COP28 meeting that this amazing speech that like Gustavo Petro gave.
Mm. Right? Oh, so, yes.
Colombian president, which is like,
yes.
He managed to connect climate change, mass migration and displacement, and then brought it back to Gaza and said like, Gaza is the future if we don't act and change it. And that was a really, I don't know. I think I've been really impressed with this
yes. whole
performance during this horrific genocide. But I think that speech is really interesting. And I think the Global South is always more or less known what this is about. And it's interesting to see, hopefully, that more countries, particularly in Latin America, because that's where I work and look at, follow that perspective.
Yeah.
But yeah, for the armed resistance, they wait and stay alive. And we've seen just the videos with the red triangles, like, what does that accomplish? Like, in a way, perhaps that level of insurgency, like discursive or digital discursivity, insurgency has done just as much as the actual like fighting on the ground, right? Like they're addressing different constituencies and different groups, but it's that symbol now. Like what happens to that symbol of the red triangle?
But you would never know without those videos what was happening to Israel's army, right? You would never know.
Oh, they no, they keep, Israel yeah, I mean, Israel keeps yeah. all that very, very, very under wraps.
So yeah. those are just symbols and ideas that will continue to live on. That's the thing. I mean, that's like, again, this idea of like different temporalities, like the Mexican government, one of the, they thought that they wiped out all these guerrillas in the 70s. And in the 90s, they're like, we're back, but we're a new generation still influenced and nourished and impressed by like the ideas and the performances of the people that you guys killed in the 1970s. Mm. So that's something that I think that also explains why this is such a widespread genocide, right? That's why they're killing kids. I think there's a recognition on the Israeli side that this is
absolutely
an important factor in a prolonged people's war, armed resistance, however we want to characterize it. So, but again, the idea that they're killing the future, the idea that they're trying to kill the future,
they won't,
and it's probably what drives me to desperation. Like I have to like to remind myself that they won't.
Yeah,
but it's just the idea that they're killing the future, and the story of the babies, like that is an attempt to kill the future. So yeah, just constantly reminding ourselves that like they won't. Yeah. It's not going to happen, even though it's pretty dark, you know, time of monster shit.
Absolutely. So we'll reconvene in 2 weeks. But yeah, like if that for me, like what I want you guys to take away, what I think people should take away is that like the goal is to hold on. And the same goes for us, right? We've just got to hold on, and we've got to just do whatever we can, which is not very much, but we just got to keep going.
It's our so digital
for all you.
I said digital war room last time, but now I'm gonna use digital insurgency after I
That's good.
Now that we have Alex, we have that
ability. Welcome, Alex.
Thank you. This was fun. This is not fun. This was therapeutic. Thank you.
Yeah. I'm so grateful for all of you guys.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you guys. Let's do it together.